Hello, and welcome to Media Ministry at Holden Village. Today's date is Friday, September 24th, 2004. Today's speaker is Cliff Hall. The lesson for today is Health and Wellness for Over 50, End-of-Life Issues. Let's listen in.
It's hard to believe, but this is the fifth of five sessions already. Just like that, it seems. Maybe it's been longer to some of you. But it's gone by rapidly for me, and it's been really a wonderful experience. Gay and I are leaving on the 10:45 bus, and then heading down lake and back home. And we're leaving a little bit early, and with some sadness. This has been just a wonderful experience for us.
You'll miss free ice cream tonight.
I know. You just have to postpone.
We'll stop at a Baskin and Robbins on the way and pretend that we're at Holden.
And as you are paying for the Baskin and Robbins, we don't have enough money.
So lest I forget at the end, I just want to express my thanks to the staff at Holden and to Janet Grant for inviting me to be a participant here. And thanks to all of you, because without you, this wouldn't happen, and your input this week has just been fantastic. I'm really impressed with this group, with your knowledge, your curiosity, your life experience, your willingness to share. That's really very, very special. To the Ella Huster group and to the other participants here, visitors to Holden that have participated in these sessions, thank you very much for everything that you've done.
Thank you
very much. I appreciate that. I want to special thanks to CJ and John for their role in the Elder Hostel, and to Don, who's is Don here? Don.
Yeah, he was here.
Don's right there. We shared a chalet with Don and gotten to know him pretty well. And it's been we've had some pretty interesting discussions about all kinds of issues, as you probably can imagine, not only about rocks, but also about some of the ethical and spiritual issues that Holden Village allows us to explore and to kind of challenge each other in our own beliefs. So that's been, thank you, Dawn. You've been a great help to us, I think, in crystallizing some of our thoughts. Anyway, this is the fifth of five. The first session, as you know, we talked about health in general, looked at it from a global perspective, how we define it, and how the great differences that exist, not only on the basis of international relations, but within communities and within this country. On Tuesday, we looked at aging and wellness and explored the difference between longevity and experiencing a meaningful life, and how our goals really, each and every one of us, want to have that quality of being able to have a purpose in life and meaning to our lives. Wednesday, we talked about faith and medicine, and we looked at some of the advantages and to a lesser extent, some of the disadvantages and potential risks that faith may bring to individuals with respect to their health and medical status. And yesterday, we started on a discussion of medical ethics and how we look at these medical problems, these dilemmas, not what's right and wrong, but how we deal with issues in which both approaches might be considered right, or both are a little bit wrong, and it's kind of hard to develop a system, a construct in which we can come to a rational, ethical decision that makes sense, that we can feel comfortable about, and that we can feel does represent the best in the human tradition in terms of caring and service. And we came up with the four basic principles by which one can judge any ethical issue, ethical problem as it relates, at least in medicine, and probably most areas of ethical behavior: autonomy, the respect for an individual, the individual's right to make his or her own decisions, beneficence, And that may be spelled wrong.
It is.
And so is my other sister. Spelling is never, I was never very good at spelling, but crossword.
Oh, don't write off my prescriptions for you.
And my handwriting's even worse. So when I'm looking at these, I'm trying to say, what was the point I was trying to make? Let's just say, do good, don't do bad, and justice. And justice is one of the overriding issues, especially as we look at health from a wider, from a community perspective. And pointed out that the medical technology has advanced so rapidly, and our ability to think through the ethical implication of these things has lagged behind. So we have a whole bunch of ethical dilemmas that we face, and these include things like transplantation, extension of life, things that we discussed here, abortion, cloning, and stem cell research, which we haven't got into, and we're not going to have time to do that. And it leads right into the whole series of decisions and concerns about end of life. And yesterday we talked about the example of not resuscitating people, pacemaker implantation and withdrawal, about refusal of care, withdrawal of care. And today we want to continue on with that discussion. Did most of you get a chance to read that article by Dr. Moore about her experience with her father and dying? And I think in that those two pages, almost every issue about death and dying came up.
A lot of us didn't get it.
Well, I have some more, and so I would.
And if we run
out of them, and we only have let's hang on to one gay so that we can Xerox a few more.
But, yeah, I can run up.
But within that article,
I pardon.
Is virtually every issue that one can deal with in death and dying in terms of. Neelius, don't fall out of it. You know, I mean, it's last meeting. We don't want broken bones or hurt somebody down here.
You should be up here sometime when the whole upstairs is full. Thank you.
And I was really touched by that and by the sincerity of that and by the agonizing that this daughter went through in dealing with her husband and wanting to do what was right for him and even knowing so much about him and even his physician friend knowing so much about him, there is this hesitancy, and there's good reason to have that hesitancy, and it's a reflection of ethical behavior when you do question what is right and what is wrong, as opposed to being convinced that you know what's right or wrong. Because most of these issues, the reason that we have trouble and there are dilemmas is that it's not that clear. And when someone is absolutely convinced that they know what's right or what's wrong, then one has to really question that. Is, you know, where does that, where it's so strong, so absolute, where does that come from? And is that necessarily the absolute right or wrong thing to do when we're dealing with human beings and human behavior for people that we love? Well, there's a number of terms that I hope that when we're done with this session today that everybody feels pretty comfortable about. And I listed them over here, and they go down refusal of care, withdrawal of care, and how is that real? Are those really different things? Are they different ethically? Are they different emotionally? I put PAS, and that stands for physician-assisted suicide, because that is a major issue. It is legal in one state and in two countries on Earth right now. It's a perfectly legal thing. And two states have voted on it and voted it down. Washington State rejected it, the state that we're in right now, and New York State voted against it. Oregon, as you know, has that law. It was passed in 1997, the legislature then became under a lot of pressure, predominantly from the Catholic Church, came and had it resubmitted to the voters 2 years later The first time it passed 52% to 47%, with 1% not voting. The next time round, it passed 60% to 40%. So over that period of time, as more people became aware of the issues, and there was more discussion, despite strong opposition from some church groups, it passed with very strong support. And it has proved to be a very workable, very successful program in Oregon.
How long do you have to be there before?
You just have to be a resident, so you can you can just come and register to vote and get your driver's license and register your car, and you become a citizen.
And you like it better than Arizona.
It rains more.
And do you know the number of individuals since then that have taken advantage of
this? Yes, the statistics have been kept by the Department of Health there because this is all reported very, very directly. And it turns out that 7 out of every 10,000 deaths in Oregon are physician-assisted suicide. It is extremely low.
7 out of 1,000?
7 out of 10,000.
10,000.
So for every 10,000 people who die in Oregon, only 7.
It's not that many that are reported.
What kind of stipulations do they have? Like you have to do this or that? Or
It's very specific. It's called the Oregon Death with Dignity Law. It throws up a whole series of steps that have to be followed. First, you have to be 18 years of age. You have to be a resident of the state of Oregon. And residency is not defined that you were born there or that you had lived there for 10 years. It's a very minimal, it's the same residency requirement to register to vote, essentially. So you have to have you have to live there. You have to have some kind of an address. You have to be certified as having a disease which has an expectancy of 6 months. That's obviously a difficult issue because it's hard to predict. And there are the length of your expected illness is not necessarily associated with your degree of suffering. You have something like amyotrophic lateral sclerosis, which is Lou Gehrig's disease. You may not be able to talk, you may not be able to swallow, and yet you may be expected with modest medical attention to live much longer than a year. And you may say, I don't want to go through this this issue for this longer time. But the way the law is written, it's very restrictive, so you have to have a physician certify that you have a 6-month life expectancy or less. The next step is that you have to give a oral request to your physician that you would like a prescription for lethal medication. That is then followed by, within 14 days, a written request. It is then followed by a referral to another physician who is asked to certify, and you're told that you can withdraw that request at any time. If you change your mind, it's perfectly okay. You then have to see another physician who confirms the diagnosis and confirms the prognosis. And the two physicians together have to decide whether or not you have some mental illness and whether or not you're competent to make this request and this decision. If you have a mental illness and depression is the greatest concern, is this somebody who's just depressed or is this somebody that really is making a rational decision about ending their life, then they need referral for psychiatric care and counseling and perhaps some medication to treat that depression. Assuming that all goes forward, you make one more oral request. And 48 hours later, you can go down, you get the prescription, you go down to the pharmacy, and you get it filled, and then you can take it whenever you wish. Turns out that more people get the prescriptions filled than take it. And that didn't surprise me at all, because I think so many people want to have the issue of control. Just to know that it's there if things got so bad. Oregon has a very high hospice use. It's been around for a long time, and it's used in virtually every community has a hospice program. So there's a lot of referral to hospice, and Oregon has the lowest incidence of individuals dying in the hospital. So more Oregonians die at home as a percentage of total deaths than any other state. So Oregon's a little bit different for a lot of reasons, and it's probably why we have a physician-assisted suicide law, is that there's been a little bit different attitude toward dying in Oregon for whatever reason. I don't really know why, I think it's reflected out of wanting to die at home and dying at home more frequently than in other parts of the country, wanting to participate in hospice programs and having the availability of hospice programs. And I think all of us know about hospice programs where individuals, you're going to die in 6 months, and they go into a hospice program, and they're suddenly part of a community of hospice nurses, of hospice volunteers, and even though no treatment is being given for their cancer or their terrible lung disease or whatever it might be, they're getting all kinds of palliative care, support, touch and warmth. And these people get better. They get kicked out of hospice after a while because you're only supposed to be in hospice for 6 months. And and then these people are there. They're there for a year. And we know that Medicare pays for you when you go into hospice. And so Medicare says, this person really isn't dying. What's the point? Because they suddenly have a reason to live. They like the hospice nurses. They like the attention and love. And I think it points out a lot of this thing about quality and meaning in one's life. Sort of a... yes,
I had a question. You probably said this and I wasn't listening. But this PAS, this physician assisted suicide, does that include poison drug on that?
No, and that's why I want to make the distinction here. That physician assisted suicide is a very, and so we define that term right now so we know what it is. Removing that pacemaker on the lady that we talked about yesterday, who we knew that if she were going to die instantly, we pulled it out. From a distance, that looks like physician-assisted suicide, but it is not. That is withdrawal of care. She's receiving something and says, "I no longer want that care." So that's let's stop doing whatever we're doing. The pacemaker is a different situation because it's in already implanted inside your body. You're walking around with it, so it seems different from being in the intensive care unit hooked up to a life support. The life support is pretty obvious. You say, "We'll stop doing this. There's no point. I don't want this done any longer." Either the patient says that or the surrogate who's making decisions for the patient. That seems pretty obvious. That's withdrawal of care. Everybody said, "Okay, that's withdrawal of care." It's a form of refusal of care, but you already started it and now you're stopping it. Physician-assisted suicide is something very different. It is suicide. The patient takes the suicide dose. Him or herself. It is not administered by the physician. It's not administered by the patient's husband or wife or loved one or anyone else. At least it's not supposed to be. The patient is supposed to be competent and capable. I immediately see the problem right there. What if you're incompetent and incapable and your quality of life is so miserable and you're in pain and you would like to commit physician-assisted suicide? You can't do it.
Well, Kavorik got into jail,
into
prison.
So that's another issue. Now that gets into euthanasia. Let's just stick to physician-assisted suicide. So it's suicide, and the only reason it's physician-assisted is that there are laws that prevent you from going down to the pharmacy and buying poison. Now you can buy rat poison. You could go down if you wanted to. Now it won't kill you as quickly, but it will kill you. You go down and get some Decon. It's rat poison. Just go down and get one of those, one bite.
And as we're speaking, my wall is being torn out because the rat with Decon got in there.
It can smell very bad. But if you took that Decon, it'll make you bleed to death. You'll bleed internally and you will die, but it's going to take several days before you die, and it won't be a particularly pleasant death, so I'm not recommending it. But you can see that. Now, that's suicide. Also, you can go down to your Kmart or wherever that you can buy a gun or your gun shop, buy a handgun, and blow your brains out. That's suicide.
That's why I wanted to ask one last question about the Oregon law. Do they specify or stipulate how it must be?
No.
You have to go get this prescription?
It says you have to get a prescription, and the assumption is that your doctor will know exactly what prescription to give and what dose and give you the proper instructions on how to do it. You can rest assured that no course in medical school has told us this is how you kill somebody. And what we have been told is that this is the dose you give for a sleeping dose.
And don't do more.
And if you give 4 or 5 of these tablets, you run a risk that somebody's going to have trouble waking up or falling down or going to break a leg. And if you give 30 of these tablets, that's a lethal dose.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Well, that you, well, 30 of those tablets is a lethal dose. Okay, here's a prescription for 30 of these tablets.
I meant, do they say what particular type of...
No. But
that's up to the doctor?
But it is well known in the medical community that it's barbiturates are what is used.
Okay.
And we have a rough idea on how big somebody is and how many to take. And you can get that information off the internet. You can get that information from the Right to Die Society, and the information is available. You can even talk to the pharmacists, know about that if you haven't been trained to do that and you don't feel comfortable about doing that. And rest assured, many physicians will not write those prescriptions. You can go to your doctor and say, I, Dr. Cliff, you've been my doctor for 30 years. I'm now dying of cancer. Cancer's all through my body. I'm racked with pain. All my relatives are dead. I don't have a thing in the world to live for. I'm ready to pass on. I'm not depressed, but I just want to control the end of my life and not just leave it to chance about what's going to happen to me. Dr. Cliff might say, that's just, again, I just can't do that. Mm-hmm. But it's important to you, Joe. Here's Dr. John down the street here, who I know has worked with patients with cancer and feels much more comfortable about doing this, mm-hmm. and has no qualms about writing this. So why don't you go see him and talk to him about it? And I'll be happy to provide the certification that you are in fact have cancer, and that you are expected to die in the next few months, and that you're of sound mind. And I'll certify that and sign off on that. But I just can't write the prescription. So there is that kind of thing. John.
You answered my question whether you were a physician was obligated.
Not in any way.
Okay.
And a pharmacist is not obligated to fill it.
Oh.
And that has created a problem because, and here's another. So the pharmacist said, I can't, you know, my religion tells me I can't be a party to suicide. it's something I can't do. The pharmacist is obligated to give you the name of a pharmacist who doesn't feel that way. That's the obligation. But we've run into problems in smaller communities, not only on this issue, but there's also on the issue of birth control pills. There are some, if you're a good Catholic pharmacist, if somebody comes in with a prescription for birth control pills, they don't believe in birth control, they say, I can't fill that. Well, you know, at what point do you, if you're licensed by the state to provide a service, can you really legitimately say, my beliefs don't allow me to do that, maybe you should be in another profession, if it's legal and it's appropriate, because barriers are being thrown up. And the birth control pill is sort of an extreme example, but what's really happening are the prescriptions for the morning after.
Morning after.
And this is a real issue because now it's not only birth control, it's people who are against birth control represent a tiny little minority. But people who are against abortion do not. I mean, that's 40, 45% of the population. And under those circumstances, if they don't want to give a... Here's an ethical thing. If you don't believe in it, you believe it's wrong, you believe it's murder, how can you... fill a prescription. You're participating in that. And if that's your ethical standard, and yet that woman has every legal right to, in the state of Oregon and to every state in this union, has an absolute right to get that prescription filled. If it's been, she's been examined, she's known to be pregnant, this is the right time, or she's been known to be exposed and potentially pregnant and wants to take those pills. The way around that is to make it available over the counter. The FDA mm-hmm. reviewed that, voted unanimously amongst the physician, the professionals, voted unanimously to have it released to be out on the market. And the director of the FDA, who is an appointee of the Bush administration, has vetoed it. So it is not available over the counter. Although,
is it in certain countries other than?
Oh, almost every country, every Western country has it available over the counter, including Canada.
You know, the whole thing about suicide, the Hemlock Society has great prescriptions for how to commit suicide.
And he's from Oregon, too.
Okay. So there are other ways to do, especially if you're not from Oregon, there's other ways to get around it, dealing with the
issue. And the issue in Kathleen Moore's article, where the couple went down and shot her and then shot himself. That is another way to do it, and it's very effective. But as he was saying, it shouldn't have to be.
It shouldn't have to come to
that. I mean, we have the technology. Why can't we make it easier for people? And and less messy and less difficult? And why does somebody have to struggle to do that? Maybe the struggle is important because you don't want to make it too easy. Bob?
Has anybody ever taken rat poison?
Yes, usually by mistake. You know, and accidental poison. I think people have probably been poisoned by it, and then there have been psychiatric patients who have taken it, and some people have taken it to commit suicide. And it causes any of you that take Coumadin, which is a blood thinner that you take for atrial fibrillation or for blood clots, Coumadin and rat poison are essentially the same chemical substance. It's just that the rat poison is about 1,000 times more potent than the Coumadin. And so you can just, and it lasts long.
Vitamin K.
You cannot block it with vitamin K because it is so powerful. You have to give blood transfusions with the special clotting factors in it, and it lasts for a month or two in your body once you take it. It's been modified. It's a modified Coumadin. And if you look at it, if you read the Coumadin, we're off on this different subject. But it's kind of interesting anyway. But it is related. Right.
Kevorkian now, and he actually is there assisting the death part, right?
I don't know where Kevorkian. I haven't heard a word about Kevorkian in the past couple of years. No, so I don't know. But we're going to get into. We'll talk about euthanasia. Let's in just a second. And that's what Kevorkian was involved in doing. John,
do you know how insurance company use physician assisted suicide? Or I mean, versus suicide. Would they honor a life insurance policy?
That's a great question.
No idea.
Has anybody? I think that they would not honor it. I think they would say it's suicide is suicide. It doesn't matter how you commit. If you have a clause in your life insurance that says void for suicide, for acts of war, you know, for you know whatever, then in those cases,
couldn't lay it off on the physician.
So does everybody have a pretty good sense about what physician-assisted suicide? It's only available. If you're in the United States, it's only available in one state and has very specific
guidelines
and steps to follow. And there was this concern that people were going to be flocking to Oregon just to take advantage. Never occurred. Now, maybe a couple people may have come in there, but from the statistics I can see, almost everybody's been living in Oregon for a long time. When people get cancer at the end of life, they don't want to go to someplace far away. And there are other alternatives. Because physician-assisted suicide has been going on. It goes on in every state in this union, but it's going on without the guidelines, without the legal protections that Oregon has. Oregon has been at least honest enough to say, look, if your doctors are doing this, and now Kathleen Moore is an Oregonian, but her father was living in Ohio, wherever, somewhere in the Midwest. And her doctor said, is it time? And they all knew what that meant. Is it time for him to give this fellow a dose of something that was going to allow him to pass on to the next world? It was being done, but it's not being done with the protections, and it's being done surreptitiously and illegally and behind closed doors and privately, and maybe that's the best way it should be. Or maybe it should be out in the open, and we should be honest about it. There's an ethical issue. You want to, you know, how do you want to handle this thing? The potential for abuse, if you're not admitting it and you're doing it quietly, is obviously much greater than to run through the stepwise fashion where you get somebody else checking to see if you're depressed, if the diagnosis is right. If you really want to do this, if you have to make three separate requests, one in writing, two orally. You have to have waiting periods. Everybody's got to be involved in it in Oregon. And that's to throw up some barriers to make sure, is this really what you want to do? As opposed to, well, let's, you know, things look kind of bad today and I feel kind of down, let's get over it.
What are the laws in some of the other foreign countries, like England, Canada?
The only other foreign country that allows it is the Netherlands. And they've had experience with it for decades. And their experience, is that it has been moving, and we'll get into this, it has been moving more and more toward euthanasia, active euthanasia. They're becoming more honest about what is going on and more liberal about what's going on. But in every country, I think, and I can't trip you, I don't know that, but in most countries, medicine has always been there to help people in the dying process by relieving pain, relieving suffering. And part of that has also been that he, as you do that, one eases death and maybe makes death a little bit quicker, a little bit easier, a little bit faster, maybe before it would have occurred had it had been totally natural. But we are, the other side of that coin is that we're certainly prolonging death in all kinds of people. And so if we're prolonging it, do we have an obligation that when it finally does come, that we not also have that obligation to see that it is quick and painless as possible as well? Because we're not following natural, nobody follows natural history anymore in this country, because something intervenes in some way. You're treated, you're given radiation, surgery, medications, chemotherapy, whatever.
But wasn't one of Dr. Kevorkian's ploys to say that what he was doing was alleviating pain in his patients, and just by accident, you know, I think this is one of his arguments early on, but it occurs to me that quite a number of parishioners that I've visited in their last days have been given morphine, and the more doses they have, that's pretty close to saying
you're absolutely right, and we're going to get down to that. And right beyond euthanasia, yeah, something called terminal sedation.
Okay, all right, yeah.
And you're just one step ahead of me, but you're right there. Can we leave physician assistants with Mary?
Well, I was just going to say that paper you gave us to read, which I did read. That, if I correct, wasn't an example of physician assisted nor euthanasia, right? It was getting to whether
it would get in between, somewhere in between euthanasia and terminal sedation. And we're going to, so that we get in there to see exactly what we're talking about, because these things are going on in your communities today. And not only in your communities, they may very well affect you in the next 10, 15 years, whenever, as we approach death. But it is happening right now. So you ought, one of the things that is worrisome to me is the fact that they're going on, and most of the population doesn't have a clue about what's going on. And you don't even get to have any realization until a loved one is in the hospital and is in this kind of situation. And that we are not being honest. Medical profession's not being honest. Patients are not being honest. Governmental agencies are not being honest. We're dealing with things and we're saying sort of this is the way it is, but what's really being done is a little bit different. Okay, so physician-assisted suicide is legal only in one place. Let's go right back, just to make it clear. Refusal of care, everybody has the right under the principle of autonomy. Nobody has to go in the hospital. No, if you're an adult and if you're of sound mind. If you're not of sound mind, and this happens for the psychiatric patients that are crazy, and you know, we can get a hold on them, we can get a two-physician hold, we can get a court order, we can forcibly admit them. We can forcibly force someone to take anti-tuberculosis medicine. Again, why? Because justice, what's the interest of the community, is more important than the person's individual rights. I don't care if I get tuberculosis. I don't want to take your stupid drugs, doctor. I can cough all over anybody I want to cough. Well, no, you can't. If we know you have tuberculosis and you refuse to take medication, the state can put you in jail. Now, they'll try a whole lot of things before they'll put you in jail, like sending out a nurse to your house and handing you the pills and making sure you take them. But if you absolutely keep refusing, you can be locked up, put in jail, and force-fed the tuberculosis medicine.
And that's all states?
I think every public, it would be very hard for a public health department to know that somebody's out there willfully. You know, it's one thing just to be out there and not know you have TB and you think you just got a chronic cough, but it's another thing if you're willfully going out and spreading the disease around. So that's the competing interest. Autonomy, we all think that's good, but justice, what's good for the many, is more important. And we pass laws that allow us to do that. So that's a refusal of care. Withdrawal of care, you're hooked up to something. Usually an intensive care unit, emergency room, somebody finds you half dead or dead out in the street, they resuscitate you, they hook you up, put tubes in your lungs and breathing for you, and you're there in an emergency room. And then the emergency room, the doctors talk to the loved ones and family and say, I've got this 98-year-old guy that somebody found, you know, dead where he was out there rollerblading or something, and he found him dead, you know, just what he wanted to do. I mean, what he wanted to do was to die quickly and suddenly doing something he loved to do. Now he's hooked up to all these machines, and the family says, hey, look, he signed advance directives. He never wanted to be hooked up to machines. This is the best thing could ever happen to him. He died while he was doing something he enjoyed. Let's withdraw that care. the ethical concern, and that's perfectly okay. No problem there. If he wakes up and says, "Get that tube out of me. I don't want to be treated," he has a right to do that. If he can't wake up, but his family says, "Withdraw the care. He didn't want it." It's withdrawn. There's no big issues about that. Except that sometimes it's hard because it's a loved one, and it's not a 98-year-old man. It's a 72-year-old woman, and it's just suddenly it's a little bit harder. Do we really continue on with this life support? And maybe there's a chance to recover, and so it becomes a little more difficult. If that 72-year-old woman has written that, "I don't want anything done, absolutely, I refuse, I don't go to doctors anyway, don't do this thing," and so when they arrive on the scene, somebody says, "Look, this person doesn't want anything done," that's refusal of care, and everybody's very comfortable with that. Withdrawal of care is emotionally more difficult, to shut something off, turn the ventilator off, remove the tubes, take the pacemaker out, do whatever. That's harder emotionally, but it's really no difference. It's just ethically, it's the same. Does everybody agree with that? Or as Dawn would say, does that make sense?
But I also heard that if you got an advanced directive that you don't want any tubes or anything, don't call the ambulance.
Good
because
point.
Because they are required to do it.
Very good.
Good point. They will. Yes. They are required to do it if they absolutely know, and because this does happen. Ambulance crews, at least in our community, ambulance crews are very much tuned in to these advanced directives. And so if you really have an advanced directive there, and somebody, usually you're unconscious, you're lying there.
It better be posted on the back door.
And if somebody actually started waving this, they would back off, at least in our community.
But this is not true in every community. People wear... When they have the advanced...
But if there's any doubt, they're going to, we mentioned before, they're going to err on the side of prolonging life, preserving life, and then deal with the issues later on. And if there really is no difference between refusal and withdrawal, all we're doing is delaying that decision by 15 minutes or a half an hour, the time to get in the emergency room, the time to assess the situation, have a little more time to think about it, talk to family members, make sure this is the right decision. Because sometimes it could be the wrong decision. Is that the person who's lying there next to the refrigerator with the thing isn't the lady who lives in the house, but it's a neighbor who came over to bring her something. She's upstairs, you know. And all, I mean, God, what a horrible thing that would be, wouldn't it? I mean, can you imagine? So you're here on the side of making sure that you got the right person, that you got, you know, let's just make, you know, I mean, and it's only...
That too,
yeah, and it's, so it may only be a 30-minute, and if you agree that there's no difference ethically between refusing to do it in the first place and withdrawing it, but emotionally, it is harder for people to say, "Let's shut off the machine," than it is, let's not go down that road at all. But does this make sense? Does this make sense, Don?
Yeah.
So those things, physician-assisted suicide, we talked about. That's suicide. Doctor just gives a prescription. Doctor could very well write 38 handgun, one bullet. You know, it could. It would work. And the only reason doctors are involved here, there are two reasons doctors are involved. One is that we have access and we have the legal right to write the prescriptions. If somebody else had the right to write the prescriptions, it would somebody else be involved. And the other thing is there's a general sense in the community that anybody who wants to commit suicide is going to be crazy. You know, because, I mean, you know, you wouldn't want to commit suicide. You have to, I mean, a norm. I mean, there's a sense out there. I don't subscribe to that whatsoever, and I suspect most of you don't either. But in society as a whole, if you commit suicide, you there's something wrong. You know, that was a diagnosis. I mean, there's something wrong. And so that if the doctors are involved, then they're going to maybe recognize that this person needs mental help as opposed to help with dying. So that's why physicians are involved.
I was thinking of, I know you went through all the process the individual has to go through. Has the court ever had to step in on a assisted suicide or down in Oregon?
If you've done it according to the rules,
it should
it will never be a coroner's. If you follow all this, because there's a huge amount of documentation and it has to be turned into the state, the state keeps track of every single one, of every person that requests, files an official request and is granted a prescription, that information goes to the state so that they can tabulate that, they follow up, they do. Here's where the state's interest in this overrides autonomy, because the state goes back and interviews family members after every case, interviews physicians after every case, to find out why did this person want this, what was the diagnosis, are you satisfied with the way it turned out, so that they can keep track of this. So there's where the state's interest overrides the desire for privacy. I mean, if I or somebody in my family wants to commit physician-assisted suicide, I don't think I want a lot of people necessarily knowing about that. Maybe I'm very proud of that, and I want everybody to know about it, and we'll write an article in the paper, and sometimes that happens. But maybe I want to be really private about it. But you can't be completely private about it, because the state has required that it keep tabs on this so that we know exactly how many people are participating. That's why I can tell you exactly how many per 1,000 deaths or per 100,000 deaths it occurs. So if you follow the rules, the answer is no, the coroner doesn't get involved. If someone dies under somewhat suspicious circumstances and someone raised a question about it, then the coroner can get involved and could go back and check to see what the level of certain medications were in the body at the time of death and things of that sort. Okay, euthanasia, different issue. It's the same end of life issue, but a different process. Euthanasia means good death, and it means some people say it's murder. It's legal murder. Okay. What does that mean? Well, how about when we send someone to be executed? And we do that in this country, some states more than other states. Texas leads Texas, Oklahoma lead the country in a per capita basis and in terms of total numbers. How are they doing that? Are they doing it by lethal injection now? That's euthanasia. That's state-sponsored, it said it's legal, somebody did something that was bad enough, or at least has been convicted of doing something. They may not have done it, but they at least have been convicted of it. And they are executed with a lethal injection of medication. And it's a combination of medications. The first, you get more than one injection, and a lot of it's very similar to what Dr. Kevorkian was doing, and this is exactly what Dr. Kevorkian was doing in the back of his Volkswagen bus with a bunch of IV things, and start an IV and then make these injections. The first dose is one of a barbiturate that puts you to sleep. And it's very pleasant. It's what and then that's followed with an injection of potassium, and that stops the heart from beating, and that kills you. And there are some other ways, there's other combinations of medications that can be used, a variety of poisons that can be administered in the vein quickly with 100% effectiveness. Physician-assisted suicide, one of the concerns has always been, what if you take those pills and then vomit? Now you get some of the pills, they're not enough to kill you, but enough to put you to sleep, or just, you know, and so that's why people have been concerned about it. You know, is it really going to work? It turns out it works very, very well, with like 99% assurance. And so there's not been a problem, at least in the Oregon experience, with people having a long death. Usually it's a matter of hours after they take the medication. I think the longest thing was somebody had lasted for 48 hours after they took the physician-assisted suicide dose. Most of them died in 12.
And were they unconscious?
They're unconscious. They're in coma.
Do they have people with them?
I'm sorry?
Are they ever alone, or do they have somebody with them?
They almost always have people with them. Almost always families involved and supportive. Or at least the ones that are supportive are there with them. They frequently call. I mean, they want control. This is the big issue. It is not pain. When you go down and do a questionnaire, so why do they do it? Number one, always, they want control over the end. It isn't that the pain is unbearable or worse than the pain of other people who choose not to die. It isn't that their nausea or shortness of breath is worse. It is predominantly that they want to have control over the end of their lives, under the circumstances, the timing. This is the time is right. Now is the time. The whole family's together. We can say our goodbyes and take advantage of that. It turns out it is not people who are worried about, or at least they don't say that they're worried about the financial situation. you know, that all this medical care and living in a nursing home or whatever it is eating up their reserves. That does not seem to be a significant issue for the overwhelming majority of people who choose physician-assisted suicide.
It just shows how
predominantly an issue of control. Euthanasia, as we said, it's an injection. So now we get in a situation, can a doctor, this is illegal in all the states. This would be, you've got your cancer, now instead of asking, what if you're paralyzed and you can't pick up the pills and put them in your mouth yourself? Now you can't commit suicide, can't do physician-assisted suicide. That's not right. I mean, that doesn't make any sense. You can understand why it's there, because when you authorize, now, so the state could say, well, in situations where people cannot do this themselves, then the state will authorize Dr. Cliff to go around and give them a shot, just like the state of Texas could authorize me, if I were willing to do it, to give the shots to the prisoners. They strap them down, they give them the shot, they certify, you know, they stop breathing, the heart stops, they're dead, wheel them out to wherever they wheel them out, and do that. We could do the same thing with people. The problem comes, you can see immediately what the problem is. If the person can't ask for it themselves, if they can't do it themselves, then someone else is doing this for them. And who is going to make that decision? And if that person, and you say, well, it's a loved one. Well, that's good. And then that might be fine. And that, in many, maybe in the majority of cases, that would be perfectly fine. But if the loved one is the son or the daughter that wants to get the inheritance, maybe that's not so good. Or if you don't have any loved ones or any real close family people and you're just kind of the old person, maybe not even that old, but that you can't talk because you've had some strokes or you've got some terrible disease, the state of Oregon, let's just say how the state of Oregon would look at this. They're paying $5,000 a month to take care of you. For what reason? What good is this person to us? Has no friends, did not contribute anything, is not working, not contributing to the gross domestic product. It's only just eating away $5,000 month after month while they're in a nursing home or feeding tube. Well, I think the state of Oregon ought to decide about whether or not this person should be killed. Ooh, not so good. I mean, we have a nice state in Oregon, but I'm not sure that any of us really want the state of Oregon or the state of Washington or the state of Missouri to make that decision, either for or against, either keeping you alive. You would like to think that that's going to be made in some other way. And if there is nobody, then at least maybe the courts will appoint someone to act as on your behalf. State itself, you don't want the state, you don't want the guy, the bean counter in there that's trying to balance the budget to be acting on your behalf. You would like
something.
Yes.
Too old.
Now the government does help, you know, the government does help, you know, and I mean, and unfortunately, the government gets a bad name in all this, you know, we have fire departments and police departments and EMTs that come and, you know, and Medicare and all the wonderful things the government does and can do for us and does do for us. So, you know, John, your statement is well taken, but when it comes down to these personal decisions, we clearly don't want that to be a faceless bureaucrat, somebody that has no obligation. So that's what euthanasia is. Euthanasia is legalized murder. I hate to use that term murder because that is so charged, but it is. It's an active killing of one person by another. The motives may be absolutely wonderful. It's an act, and as Kathleen Dean Moore says, killing, it's beyond ethical categories, it's beyond laws, it's beyond two signatures and review panels. Nothing requires it, nothing justifies it. Greater than justice, it is an act of mercy, an act of love. It is a wrong that cannot be forgiven. It's both those things. It's the greatest gift one can give to another, a gift of stupendous, titanic love is a wrong that cannot be forgiven. I mean, that's an ethical quandary. That's an ethical dilemma. That's as tough as it gets. But the thing is, it's being every day, right now, all around, right in this state, right down in Wenatchee, there's probably a decision being made, and patients are getting terminal sedation. We're going to get into that. Physician-assisted suicide in Oregon is taking place. These very critical, important decisions are taking place. I mean, this is not abstract, you know, let's go to Holden Village where life is unreal in many ways, and it's a beautiful, wonderful place, and we can talk about these
have these wonderful discussions about rocks and about creation and about love and togetherness and all the kind of issues that are so wonderful to talk about. But we're talking about things that are in, out there in the real world are taking place right this minute and are going to affect almost every one of us. Some of us are going to drop dead and nobody's going to call 911 and it's going to be quick. But most of us are going to have an illness. Something's going to be involved. We're going to be in the medical care system in some way, either refusing care, having care withdrawn, thinking about physician-assisted suicide, having somebody sneaking around wondering about euthanasia, or you want it, and terminal sedation. Well, what is terminal sedation? Anybody know what terminal sedation is?
Give a drug that keeps you under?
Terminal sedation is something that's being practiced more and more.
A little more morphine.
Morphine. Essentially, it's morphine. Now, and morphine and morphine-like drugs. And they can be administered either with patches on the skin, fentanyl patches, you heard of fentanyl patches, they work very well. Or it can be administered orally, or down through a tube, or more commonly, can be administered through a vein. So you start a little intravenous, and you give some morphine. Well, it's an extension of what? Of giving some morphine for pain. Somebody has pain, or they have anxiety, or stress, for whatever condition. You just had surgery on your knee, you had a total knee replaced, and it's extraordinarily painful. That first day, that first night after surgery, almost certainly you're going to get some morphine or something very similar to morphine. You may take it orally, they may give it to you in the vein. If it's really painful, the nurse will come by and give you a shot in the vein, and you'll feel better and you'll sleep. And that's I know of no one that says that's a bad thing to do.
Other than when you give it to my daughter, she turns violent.
Oh, okay, but I mean, if you're not allergic to it, don't have a reaction to it. Sure, but in terms of, I mean, I suppose there may be some people who say that pain is good, and that pain is a learning experience, and that pain is, you grow with pain, and God made you, wanted you to have pain or something. But most of us, I think probably everyone here would say, Doc, give me a shot of morphine. You really, really dinged up my knee here with that total knee replacement. And I know I'm going to be walking around here tomorrow, and a month from now I'm going to be out hiking in the hills again, but I want that morphine tonight. Well, is the next step, it's not your knee surgery you had. Now it's you've got a cancer of the lung that has spread into your bones. And it's eating away at your bones and it's causing a tremendous amount of pain. The cancer has spread extensively. You've lost 30 pounds. You're very weak. Brought in the hospital because you, in addition, have a little pneumonia now, and you're lying there in bed, and you're in great pain, and the doctors come by and say, well, let's start some morphine for this poor soul and relieve his pain. And so you give some morphine, and then you give a little more morphine because the pain is still there. And now Joe is becoming pretty sleepy from the morphine. You can still wake him up, and he can talk to you, but that's a side effect of morphine. That's the way morphine works. But his pain is a little bit better. And then the question is, does he go home with that morphine intravenously? Can we really relieve all of his pain? He's still having some. We give him a little bit more. Now he's not eating very much because he's sleeping most of the day. He looks even worse. Why don't we just increase the morphine a little bit more and really keep him comfortable? Because he moans so often. Now we're getting into something called terminal sedation, because we know this person has a terminal illness. They are dying. They're going to die maybe sometime in the next 2 to 3 weeks if we didn't do anything, or maybe the next 2 or 3 months. We don't really know, but we know that they're going to die during this period of time. They clearly don't have any reasonable hope of recovering from the disease. There's no treatment for this bone cancer because it's spread through bones all through the body. He did get some radiation therapy, 6 months ago for the first one that showed up in his shoulder, but now it's everywhere. There's nothing, with chemotherapy isn't going to work. Nothing's going to help this person. He wouldn't want it anyway, and it wouldn't be appropriate anyway, because it would just add more complications. So the morphine gets cranked up a little bit. Not being fed, because he can't eat. The doctor comes by and says to the family, do you want us to put a feeding tube into Joe? And they said, well, no, I mean, he's dying. Why would we put it? We're just trying to keep him comfortable. We're relieving his pain. We just want to
make sure he's not suffering anymore. No, no feeding tube. And he said, well, do you want us to give him intravenous fluids enough for hydration? And you say, well, why would you do that, doctor? I said, well, there's really no good reason for that. That would just kind of prolong his death, as opposed to give him any quality of life. So that's perfectly okay. And ethically, that's perfectly fine, except if your name is Terry Schreiber,
right,
in Florida, where there's a law that says you can't take away food and supportive stuff. That's another whole other issue. But the Supreme Court has said it's perfectly okay not to give somebody food and beverage if they're dying. That's perfectly okay. So we are in a situation of terminal sedation. They're getting morphine in the vein, not enough morphine to just kill them right there, but enough morphine to put them into a coma. Essentially, what we've done. And the morphine continues to go, continues to run. The nurses come by and say, you know, seemed a little your patient was a little restless last night. He was moving around in bed, and we adjusted the sheets, and he moaned. We think he's still having, maybe still experiencing some pain. Well, you're dying. You're going to die at any point. You don't want anybody to have any pain. Why have any pain? Okay, nurse, let's increase the morphine from 4 milligrams an hour to 8 milligrams an hour. And the intent is to relieve pain, relieve suffering. But the effect? Kill the patient. Shorten the life. Make the death easier. Now, if you went around the United States and asked physicians, what are you trying to accomplish when you're giving this terminal sedation? And let me tell you, terminal sedation happens every day in our hospital. And it happens every day in all of your hospitals. I can guarantee that. I don't care if it's a Catholic hospital or a Jewish hospital, Mount Sinai, or whatever it is, it's being done.
And they go right through there.
Yes?
My mother was in hospice and she had ALS, and they called us and said she has about 24 hours to live. How they knew that, I don't know. So I went and saw her. They gave her morphine, the shot, and then they kept just giving her the morphine. And she died about 24 hours later. And when I was thanking the nurse, I said, thank you for helping her. She said, oh, we didn't do anything. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, I think the morphine did something.
Morphine
helped. She died very quietly.
She died peaceful and quietly.
Very, and that was the nurse.
And that was the right, and mm-hmm. I personally, I say that's the right thing to do. And it's, so it's happening in your hospitals. It's also happening in hospice situations.
Right.
It's happening at home when home health comes by to take care of the people with who are dying anyway. Yes, Pete.
One question. Physician assistant to suicide. If a person is paralyzed, he's laying in bed, and he can still blink, and he has yes or no, can I have the pill to end my life? Is that possible, or is that going to euthanasia?
A great question. It blurs the distinction. If he's paralyzed and cannot physically put the pills into his mouth. Now, you can communicate. He says, I want to die. I want the prescription. And I want you, and you could be the doctor, it could be the nurse, it could be his daughter, it could be his loved one. I want you to put the pills in my mouth for me, and I can swallow still, but I just can't physically put them in. It would fall into the category of euthanasia, even though by all of the criteria, it's just he can't do it himself. And so it's illegal. He couldn't do it in Oregon legally, but what would happen if he has a compassionate family and a compassionate physician? The doctor would say, look, we'll mix this up into a liquid. Here it is. He needs to take that himself. Go out the room, and I don't care who gives it to him. Okay, I've legally done what I've done. They're not gonna, put me in the Salem's pen for murder. And the daughter or the loved one says, here, Pete, drink this, and we all love you, and it's been a great life, and good luck. And
so
that's the end.
Still drink it with a straw,
or whatever. But they're going to feel comfortable that they were doing what he wanted to do. We all feel that was done right, but in the actual letter of the law, and that's why when you stop making all these restrictive laws, it becomes very, it just becomes very hard. But a very, very important point.
Yeah,
but
so
if you
want, okay.
When you're done, I was just thinking about the
what is it called? Terminal sedation. Is there a possibility that the states will try to put laws on that?
Yes, absolutely.
And if they do, then that's
the
really going to put a lot of, I mean, you don't want to have to sign a paper of your love for your loved one to say, you know, I want them to have enough morphine to make them comfortable. I mean, the doctor should be able to do that when the time comes without making a big legal issue of it, because that just hurts more.
Sure. A wonderful point, and here we have competing interests here, because what about, it gets back to that issue that I talked about the other day about the state of Oregon making decisions. Who makes decisions for people? And most of us, we're here in a loving community. We have loved ones, we have family members, we have a good close friend who knows what our values are, that most of us have probably signed living wills and have indicated someone to make that decision. But there are a lot of people out there who are not in that situation. And someone is going to have to make decisions for them. And so when we get into this, what are the protections of the individual? When it's do no harm, when someone's life is being shortened, and someone says, the quality of this person's life is so miserable, maybe it isn't so miserable to that person. Maybe we would say we would never live under those circumstances, would never want to live under those circumstances. But someone else, I go back to Kathleen Dean Moore's thing about, if she says yes, he was still hearing the lawnmower, and that brought him pleasures. He thought about the lawn, but then he was an entomologist. He thought about the insects and things of that sort, that he was still getting some pleasure. And we would look at it and say, well, this guy's life is just awful. Let's finish them off. Who's going to make those decisions? And that's where we get into trouble. That's where you need the law to step in and set some guidelines and some boundaries. Because, as I started to say, if you went around to the doctors in the United States right now who are using terminal sedation, and I use terminal sedation, and every physician that's involved in a hospital setting is doing this, because this is compassionate care. Because, and yes, what were you trying to achieve? And I will tell you that 95% of physicians say, oh, we're trying to relieve pain and suffering. And you say, were you trying to hasten death? Oh, no, that was just an unintended side effect of giving the medication. Why would I answer that question that way? Because if I say my intent really was to kill this person, kill them more quickly. What do you think that the state of Oregon can charge me? Murder. Really, murder. Not just malpractice. I mean, not just that my insurance company writes a check for $1 million to a family. No, that I could actually go to jail. I mean, I probably wouldn't. I mean, I think realistically, I don't know, some people would love to convict me of something. But I think realistically, it would be very hard in that setting for a jury of 12 people to, you know, especially if the family was supportive of what was being done, everything else, you know, for some hotshot district attorney to try that. But we had a situation in Corvallis about 20 years ago, before it was really considered okay not to feed somebody, where one of our oncologists sent a patient to a nursing home to essentially starve to death. Had some pain medicine, wasn't getting really terminal sedation in the typical sense of the word, and was not being fed. This was before the AMA and the Supreme Court said it was okay. This is only 20, 25 years ago. I mean, this is a rapidly changing field. The district attorney was informed by a very fundamentalist person who worked in the nursing home that this person was being killed, starved to death. Now, I know the physician involved. He's a good friend. He had long discussions with the family. The family was totally supportive of what was going on with this person who had a terminal illness. District attorney started proceedings against this physician, and the charge would have been murder or attempted murder. Totally, absolutely inappropriate, wrong, the wrong decision, the wrong thing, but because the right thing was being done for this person. He after some consultation with this, as I understand it, with the Attorney General of the State of Oregon,
He was told not to proceed, and he didn't, and it was dropped. But that kind of thing can happen. So if you ask doctors, what are you doing? 95% are going to say, I'm relieving pain. I'm not intending in any way to shorten the life. There will be always a few mavericks who will be very honest and right up front and say, we certainly wanted to relieve pain, and that was certainly a part of it, but a good part of it was also to hasten death. In the Netherlands, where they do this very, very frequently, they did a big survey of physicians and said, why are you doing this? 36% of the physicians said they did not intend to hasten death. 17% said that they were doing both. They knew that they were... 47% acknowledged that they were doing both. 17% were totally upfront and honest and said that what they were trying to do was induce death. And the way I read that, of the 47% that were acknowledging both, probably the majority of them felt that hastening death was the primary goal, and relieving suffering obviously was also part of that. I mean obviously, hastening death in a horrible situation is relieving suffering. There's no question about it.
Is there any pain reliever that is as effective as morphine, or especially one that would allow the patient to be awake?
Boy, that will be a billion-dollar drug. And the drug companies have really and are continuing to try to do that. The answer is no, there is not. There is nothing even close to it. So I don't know that, the receptors in the brain that are there for our endogenous morphine kinds of substances. We produce endogenous chemicals that are very similar to morphine that circulate, and under conditions of pain and stress, they increase in our bodies, and they're designed to help us get through some of these things, but they're not anywhere near the concentration that we need to really get relief from severe pain.
So we've had morphine for a long time.
Morphine's been around.
Well,
it's been around for centuries and centuries. People have known about it. Poppy plants. Opium has been clearly around. And it's very addicting, and that's just a whole other issue of no concern in this kind of setting, and should never be even considered in somebody with a terminal illness. They worry about addicting someone to it. I think you can see where the distinction between euthanasia and terminal sedation can get very... Euthanasia, we push it in quickly, heavy, big dose, kills you just like that. So that your total time on the Texas execution table is 10 minutes. You go in from a healthy buck, young buck, to a corpse in 10 minutes. That's it. It's over. You're pronounced dead, you're out. In someone with a terminal illness who's dying, it's going to take place over a period of hours, or more likely over days, sometimes weeks.
Is the Pope against all of these?
Interesting, really? That you should bring up the Pope.
I mean, he's constantly coming out with things, where people are starting to modify things, and then he comes in and says, nope, it's off.
The Pope, believe it or not, this Terry Schiavo case, which I'm just going to tell you about very, very briefly. Does anybody have any other questions? Because this kind of relates to that, and the Terry Schiavo case kind of draws a whole bunch of this stuff together. And it is an important, it's something you're going to be reading more about in the newspapers. You probably already are familiar with this.
Yes.
If you're not familiar, I'll just give you a real quick background on Terry Schiavo. Terry Schiavo is a lady who's from, originally her maiden name was Schindler. She's from Pennsylvania. She married... a guy and moved to Florida. Somewhere at the age of 27, I think she was, 24. She was 24. She developed an eating disorder. She was anorexic. She lost some weight. She had a seizure or a heart attack. It's not clear what happened to her. She was taken to the hospital. She was resuscitated. She had brain damage, significant brain damage. While in the hospital, she had another episode. I don't know the details. But she had like another cardiac arrest, was resuscitated from that. They screwed some things up during that cardiac arrest, various wrong medicines or whatever went on, and she had more brain damage. malpractice suit was filed by her husband against the hospital and against the physician taking care of it, and they won $1 million judgment against the hospital. Terry Schiavo's, this you never read about in the paper. I mean, everything about Terry Schiavo was about Jeb Bush pulling the tube out and all this other kind of stuff, and she's brain dead and all this other kind of stuff. But you, what you don't know about, there's $1 million out there, and it's designed for supporting her. There was $300,000 damages and $700,000 for her ongoing care, because she was, a quote, pretty much a vegetable. She had a feeding tube put in so they could feed her because she couldn't swallow. And her husband, for the last several years, has been petitioning the courts, saying that she would never want to continue on this way. She does not relate to anybody or anything in any way. She's a vegetable, if you will. I mean, that's a bad, not a medical term. She is in what's called a persistent vegetative state, and I'm going to define that to you in just a second. And he wants to get the feeding tubes out, allow her to die. That would all be really fine, except that he's not the world's greatest guy. In terms of, in some ways. Some people say he was responsible for, or at least her family thinks that he's responsible for her eating disorder in the first place. That he wasn't a particularly good husband, and that it was all his stress that led to that. And they say, and the family thinks he wants the money. And the family says he has been living with this other woman for the past several years, and has a couple children with her, and that if he really were a good husband, he wouldn't be doing that. And maybe all those things are true. However, he is still married to Terry. He did not divorce her. And that, according to law, he is the person that ought to be able to make decisions for her. He also claims that they had discussions before, and that she would never want to go on this way. No one knows whether they ever had those discussions. Family says they never heard her discuss anything. She never filled out a living will. She never abused a 20. Who would think a 20-year-old needs to do this? Every major issue, Karen Ann Quinlan, Nancy Prusin, and Terry Schiavo, they've all been in their 20s. Tell your kids, your grandkids, they need living wills to be filled out when once they get to be 21 years old, because these are the ones that go to court. You know, you never read about some 80-year-old person full of feeding. Who cares, you know? But it's a 24-year-old person becomes very important. Several courts, several judges have reviewed this. Everyone says he should make the decision. It's okay. Pull the tube out. And following the last one, she was moved to a nursing home. They pulled the tube out. Within 24 hours, the Florida legislature met, because now the parents of this girl think that she's communicating. They think that she's still migrating out, and that they think that starving her to death is the wrong thing to do. They're good. It's a good Catholic family on that side.
And is she in a coma?
Great question. She's in a persistent vegetative state, and I'm going to tell you about that in just a second.
How many years?
I'm sorry.
How many years?
She's been in there since 1990.
Wow.
I know. It's
go on. I knew it was a long time. I didn't know.
This sounds like 2020.
Well, that's only four. Four years.
Only.
1990. It's 14 years, right? Yeah. Uh-oh. Well, somebody else take over this discussion. Don, in geologic time, 1990, 2004, you couldn't tell the difference. You know, how old is this rock? You give me this rock within 5 years, I couldn't do it.
You ever have to do subtraction and writing out prescriptions?
There's just no respect around here.
A mind is a terrible thing.
It's gone.
Are you sure you know the practicing medicine still?
Anyway, it's been since 1990, so we're really... Well, that's right. She's in her late 30s right now. And this fighting is still going on. The most recent court was that she should be able to have this out. It was pulled. She was in the nursing home. The tube was pulled, and within 24 hours, the state legislature and the state of Florida passed a law, which has been known as Terry's Law, because it really only applies to Terry, and essentially it says that you cannot remove a feeding tube from Terry. And so, it's the only situation probably in the world where a legislature would pass a law that only applies to one person. You know, it's kind of bizarre, but that's the way it was. Jeb Bush signed it. President Bush weighed in and said that he thought this was the right thing to do, is that put the tube back in. She has the tube back in now. And so she is being fed while this is still being appealed in the courts. Now, the Pope also came out and weighed in on this as well. Talk about what's he got to do with this, you know. But anyway, he does. He thinks he does. Or the people around him think he does. And it gets down to what's going on with this lady, what's going on in her brain. Now, there are three states relating to brain damage in someone that's not responding to you, that's had a brain injury or lost circulation to the brain for a period of time. Coma, persistent vegetative state, brain dead. Three distinct, clearly different entities. Up until the late 1980s, persistent vegetative state was not known. You were either coma or you were brain dead. Prior to 1970, it was coma or you were dead. We didn't even use brain dead as a criterion for death, but we had to do that for the transplant business. Because then we have to say, well, because we always define death prior to that time, breathing and heartbeat. Okay. Well, we talked yesterday about keeping somebody alive, keeping the corpse alive, so that we could keep the organs, but the brain is dead, the person is dead, and legally that person doesn't exist anymore. The person is wiped from the rolls because they have brain dead. So we have to figure out a way to define brain dead as opposed to persistent vegetative state, as opposed to coma. Okay, well, what are these three conditions, these three states? Coma is a situation where you're unresponsive and can't wake you up. Sleep, we know what sleep is. You may look like coma, but it's not coma, because if you shake somebody hard enough, you can wake them up. That's sleep. Sometimes it's really hard to wake people up, you know, but that's still sleep. They can't wake up. And if you look at brain waves, they have brain wave activity. They're breathing on their own. The lower functions of work, that's sleep. Coma, you can't wake them up. Doesn't matter what you do. You stick pins in them, you stick needles into them, you chop off their arm, they just lie there. And, I'm trying to make a point that you can induce pain, where somebody's faking it.
Well taken.
If somebody's faking it, you know, at one point with the pain, they'll start to grimace or move. Because people do try to fake it sometimes, like they're unresponsive, you know. They're lying there. We deal with crazy people in hospitals. Yeah. The doctors are crazy.
Is there any time limit associated with it?
No. No time limit associated with whatsoever. Coma, but what's going on in coma is that your basic level of the lower levels are working fine. Your breathing, temperature regulation, blood pressure control, that's all working just fine. But you can't wake you up. So we don't know if they're thinking or hearing anything or any, know have any sense of what's going on. But if we go, we hook you up and we do some brainwave tests, we can see that there's brainwave activity. Sometimes you look perfectly normal. Say, gee, well, you know, normal brainwave activity. If we do some very sophisticated scans, MRI scans and PET scans and some of these radionuclide scans that look at various brain function, the brain looks like it's normal. You know, there's brain out there, it's working, but the person just can't wake up. That's coma. But there is evidence, and if you do look at circulation to the brain, there's circulation to the brain, to the main parts of the thinking part of the brain, the neocortex of the brain. Persistent vegetative state, PVS, is somebody that looks like they're in coma. They're lying there, they're breathing, temperature regulation, blood pressure's okay, you can't wake them up.
But the brain.
But when you do the tests, there's no brain activity. There's nothing up there. It's gone. It's been destroyed. You look, there's no circulation to that part of the brain. There's some scar tissue and some something that's up there, but there's essentially no functioning cortex.
Why isn't that brain dead?
Because they're breathing and their blood pressure is working. And there are
people breathing who are brain dead?
No. No, if you're brain dead, you have lost all brain function. There are different levels of the brain. There's the thinking part of the brain, there's the motor parts of the brain, and there are the basic regulatory parts of the brain, which are the most basic. We talk about the reptilian brain. It's in the very lowest parts of the brain, and they control the most basic things. That's why when people die, the last thing they do, that last gasp, you know, the death rattle, the last, I mean, that's the last thing to go. When the brain is pretty much all gone, down to the very end, you still have some control of the heart rate. But if you're truly brain dead, the rest of your body's going to die pretty soon thereafter, within hours or certainly within a day. You're not going to have a brain dead person that's alive, that's not on mechanical support, because you're going to stop breathing. Once that brain is gone, you're going to stop breathing eventually, sometimes in a matter of minutes, sometimes in a matter of hours or days, but you're definitely going to stop. Your blood pressure is going to fall out. You're going to have all kinds of crazy temperature problems. Temperature regulation is a basic brain control mechanism.
Because if they want to use the organs, don't they have to keep that person on machines?
That's right, exactly. And you have to be brain dead. You cannot take the organs from somebody in coma. That would be bad form. And it's even worse if you take it from somebody who's asleep. That's coma.
Unconscious
equals coma. Or it could be deep sleep.
So if somebody's in an auto accident or they fall out of a tree or something, they're unconscious for a few moments.
They're coma.
They're actually in a coma.
They're in a coma just for, they had a concussion that, yes, Harley.
On the other hand, comatose patients who even after 10 or 12 months, all of a sudden one day wake up.
Absolutely right.
Just marvelous.
It is absolutely right, and it's not a surprise. It shouldn't be a surprise because we know that their brain is there. We know it's functioning. It's something just has to reconnect in some way so that they become alert. But a persistent vegetative state, you never wake up because there is nothing to wake up. The brain is gone. A brain dead, you can't wake up because that's gone, plus your basic lower centers are gone, and you're dead, and you're legally dead as well as physically dead.
Ted has a question.
We're running out of time. What did the Pope do?
Okay.
Yeah.
We are running out of time.
You know, I would like to end this session with a love story.
Okay, let me just give the Pope thing just so that we do
Pope
know.
And then Marian. I think that's the order of things here.
All right.
We'll go. The Pope turned out something that's called a teaching to the faithful. It was delivered at the International Congress of Physicians in Rome at a meeting, and so he weighed in specifically as it relates to these issues. And a teaching to the faithful is different from an infallible thing from the Pope. So the Pope admits that he might be wrong. He didn't say it that way, but when the Pope does have one at this level, it's a lower level statement from the Pope. But he says, you cannot predict who will recover. He's wrong. Pope was fallible on that one because we can predict who won't recover. And the Pope said, you can't. So the Pope has lumped everybody into the coma category as opposed to knowing that, and did not take into account the advisors to him. Did not explain to him, or he didn't understand, that we do have technology that can actually separate those two groups of people. He made three points. The second part, a man will never be a vegetable or an animal, and that they should, regardless of what state he's in, should be treated with respect. Nobody's going to argue with that. One can argue that if you are brain dead, you are dead, you no longer are a person at that point. But certainly somebody in persistent vegetative state does not have the potential of ever waking up. And the Pope said that food and water is natural, even if given artificially, and that we have an obligation to give that, in his opinion. And it's given for comfort, just like putting a blanket over somebody. That is not what the courts in the United States have ruled, that if it's administered artificially by a tube, it is a treatment, because the tube is not managed. The tube is put in by a physician. A tube is managed by the physician. It's a medical procedure, and therefore it falls under medical care as opposed to just. So in general, the medical profession would say we don't agree with the Pope on those issues. But you can see the complexity in this particular case and in the case of Kathleen Dean Moore of all these things interplaying. We are running out of time.
Okay,
we
if I could have 1 or 2 minutes, I would.
Oh, you can take 5 or longer because I don't think anybody has any place they have to go, and we don't have to leave.
All right. I would like to. We've been talking a lot on left brain stuff, and I'd like to share a love story with you that is strictly right brain, and of course, it involves some left brain decisions also. As some of you already know, I lost my husband 5 months ago after 52 years of marriage. He was an engineer, very left brain, married to a very right brain person, which is, yeah, I don't need to go any further than that, but just to explain to you where he was coming from as far as his viewpoint on life, etc. He'd been very, very healthy, and he taught up until 3 years ago. I had a career of teaching on a university level. 2 years ago, he had a stroke. And then it was followed up a few months later with bypass surgery. And then he had about a year later, he had a back problem. Anyway, during all of these other incidences, this man worked. He did everything that he could do to rehabilitate himself. There wasn't anything that the doctors told him or the therapist told him to do that he didn't do. He even would stand, I'm a music teacher as well as an art teacher, and he would stand by the piano because his voice was affected right after the stroke. And I would do exercises with him, and he would repeat an echo kind of thing. And this man has never, ever, ever, ever have I done this with him. I've done it with my music students, but I never thought my husband would ever do this. But he says, when and if he goes, that it's not going to be anything, the cause wasn't going to be anything that he didn't do. This is his very straight, this is the way it was going to be. So anyway, it was about 7 months ago that he had surgery on his back. And he aspirated during the surgery, it choked him, and he died on the surgery table. And he was gone for 10 minutes. They resuscitated him, of course, because he's in surgery. And he was in intensive care for about 3 or 4 days and came home. He died again a second time exactly 1 month later, but the second time was a permanent death. But what happened in between that time is what I want to share with you. After he died the second time, I thought, why in the world was he saved the first time? Why this month? Well, a couple of things happened, and I'm basing this, my life and his life has a very strong spiritual base. Our regular family doctor, of course, had nothing to do with any of his hospitalization, because once you get into the hospital, you're put into other doctors. Our doctor was a family doctor. Came to visit Chuck every day. He'd been our family doctor for 20 years, and he's a Christian man. And when Chuck came up out of surgery, and they had revived him, of course, he was quite ill, and our doctor came in, and he put his hands on him. Literally, well, figuratively, he put his medicine case down in his bag on the floor. He put his hands on my husband's chest, and he said, "God, let this man live." I mean, it just blew me away. Well, the man did live. And the next 2 weeks were the most glorious 2 weeks of our 52 years of marriage. Once you have died and you come back to life, your world changes. And you begin to see things that you have never seen before. And for my left-brained husband, he was seeing things that I was rejoicing in because I had seen them so much in my life. And we came together. Those 2 weeks were like a honeymoon, not knowing that he was going to die. So soon afterwards. But we talked about a lot of things about our lives. We laughed, we cried, we prayed together. We told each other how much we loved each other. And then after 2 weeks, one morning I woke up and he was in a coma. What had happened was that he had pneumonia, and it was really walking pneumonia. I had a feeling that possibly this was pneumonia, but the doctor couldn't detect anything. He, you know, there were no rattles, no shakes, no nothing. And what happened was when he went into the coma, this pneumonia just really hit hard. And because he'd been through so much and he'd lost so much weight and so forth, he just didn't have the ability to handle this pneumonia in a younger person and probably would never have gone to this point. And his whole body was poisoned. Got him to the hospital and he died on his, well, 2 days after his 80th birthday. He was in the hospital during his birthday. He had a living will. He had told me many times before, he said, Marianne, I don't know when I'm going to die, but he said, I'm ready. I've lived a long life. I've had a long career. I've done many, many things that has really fulfilled my life. I have a lovely family. He said, I'm ready to go anytime the Lord wants me to go. And so he was ready. We had the living will. And of course, he was in intensive care the last time around. And then he was hanging in there. And then suddenly all the numbers were going down on the machines. And we knew that it was coming to an end. And the only thing left was the feeding tube. And they got ready to put it in. And I said, sorry, this was an agreement between my husband and I that there was no feeding tube. And it was my decision to remove all life support. So we did. And I did it out of love. And I didn't allow myself to feel any way differently. They took the whole bed and myself, and we went up to a private room, and they put him on terminal sedation, and I laid with him for 6 hours till he died. And it was the most beautiful death that I have ever, well, I've not experienced many deaths, but it was a most beautiful thing that I experienced. It was a privilege to have carried this out, knowing that the Lord was with us, that we were doing Chuck's will as well as the Lord was taking him. And I can't tell you, well, our doctor said that of all the deaths that he's experienced, Chuck died, he had more dignity in his death than anybody he'd ever known. Because Chuck said in the hospital, right before he was put on terminal sedation, he was awake, and he said to the pastor as he was giving him the last rites, he said, I'm ready. How much more beautiful can life be? And I just wanted to share that with you, because we've been talking a lot about hard data, about this and that and the other thing, but there is the human side of it. And make it as much as you can towards that kind of end of life. It has to be a communication, a solid agreement between you and your spouse or your whatever. And we did it. We've always worked as a team, and we were a team to the end. And I don't regret any bit of what happened. Thank you, Mary. You're welcome.
A beautiful, a lovely story.
It's
to bring
a love
our
story.
To bring this whole series of lectures to go and conferences and to go from where we presented some we started out with just a bunch of numbers up on the board, and we end up with a touching love story. Really, what it is. You've all been really wonderful. I do have some, just to get my left brain to make a couple statements, I do have some some sample advanced directives and power of attorneys that I...